You've just tuned into Outdoor News Radio, a weekly showcase of the top outdoors writers and experts in Minnesota and across the region. I'm Outdoor News Managing Editor Rob Dreeslein, and I'm honored to have you join us for the next hour as we break down hunting, fishing, and natural resources topics affecting your ability to recreate in the Western Great Lakes and beyond. Our guests might challenge you occasionally, but we promise to entertain you while we're at it. Don't go away, because if you love this state's fine outdoor scene, you'll love Outdoor News Radio. Today's show is brought to you by Ducks Unlimited. If you'd like to help a DU chapter or start one in your area, go to www.volunteers.ducks.org. You can make a difference. Howdy, everybody. Welcome to Outdoor News Radio. Another week is here, and we're happy to be with you for the next hour. I am Rob Dreeslein. We'll have Tim Lesmeister with you toward the end of the show. In between, I think we're going to talk some trout. We might talk steelhead. We might talk a little fly fishing. So please stay tuned. I think next week I'll have Mark Strand with us. We'll talk turkey hunting tactics a little bit. Turkey season is underway as we speak. April 17th, it kicked off this past Wednesday. So congratulations to everybody who's out there turkey hunting all week. I suspect next week's paper we will already have some gobblers in the paper. Kicking it off, though, with Tim Spielman. Tim, welcome. You got a turkey tag for this year?
No, not yet. It's one of those things I usually wait until later and see if I'll have time.
Mm-hmm.
I do like turkey hunting, but I've done it plenty in the past, but haven't bought a permit yet this year, so we'll see what happens.
Yeah, it's a little different than it was in the old days when you had to apply for that permit in advance, and if you got one, then you usually would carve out vacation time, you'd be all set, and everyone was serious. Now it seems a little more like, well, what's the weather look like the next few days? Gosh, it looks pretty good. Maybe I'll go buy a tag and go hunting. It's a different vibe than it was back when we were trying to build preference points. Remember that?
Yeah, especially when it might not be on your mind, but like last week, as I drove to town for something, and you go past a field and see 20 turkeys out there, including a couple toms that are all fanned out, then you all of a sudden think, geez, I should get a permit.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
There are certain things that inspire you.
My dad says he hasn't seen any on his place yet. He was wondering if some of the birds were still kind of flocked up. You know, they were still in some big flocks like what you just mentioned. Mm-hmm. You would think with the lack of snow and the balmy weather that those flocks have busted up and there's more individual birds kicking around.
Yeah, I haven't seen that, but from what I've seen, and this was just recently, that was a flock indeed, and it was a big one.
Well, Tim, a lot cooking again, as I always like to say, in this week's print edition of Outdoor News. We're down to about a month on the legislative session. Brian Mosey with a pretty significant capital roundup. It sounds like the environment bills have passed both the House and the Senate floor votes. They need to be reconciled in conference committee. There's a lot of different things in each bill. There's some commonality. But as you and I were talking a little off here, you never really know what's going to happen until that conference committee meets, because there's a lot of wheeling and dealing that goes on behind those closed doors.
Yeah, for sure. If nothing ever matches up perfectly, and a couple of items we'll probably talk about, they're a ways from the finish line if the House has something and the Senate does not, or vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be fun to find out how all that wheeling and dealing works, because I'm sure it's a lot of give and take, but who wants to give and who wants to take and how much? And it's almost like the NFL draft, Rob.
Well, and with Democrats having majorities in both the House and the Senate, it's probably a little less dramatic than it was a few years ago. You know, when you had committee chairs from different parties coming together and really, really locking horns potentially. This year, we got Rick Hansen in the House and Senator Herr from St. Paul in the Senate. They probably agree on most things, but there's some give and take. A couple specific issues. We had a commentary from Steve Drazkowski, Republican down in Mazeppa. Is that where he hails from?
Yep.
And I had him on radio last year. Draz, we've had some fun with him over the years, but he's pushing hard on this statewide rifle zone, getting rid of the shotgun zone. You know, I thought he made a pretty strong case, and he's dug out some stats too.
Mm-hmm.
That I had never seen before. That there's a case to be made that rifles are more precise and actually safer than shotguns. I didn't completely agree with some of his numbers there. I mean, you know, talking about shotguns shooting out to over 200 yards. I mean, even with a sabo slug and a rifle barrel, I don't feel comfortable shooting my shotgun to those kind of distances. Then again, maybe there's some newfangled rifle barrels and better slugs that and people who just shoot better than me, Tim, who are comfortable shooting to that kind of range. But I thought it was an interesting piece, but still not going anywhere this year. Or do you disagree?
Well, that's one of the items that is in the story this week. We thought we were moving toward, I thought we were moving toward getting this done so we could quit talking about it. But, you know, like we talked about earlier off air, we get lots of letters to the editor about mm-hmm. this. People have an interest in it, that's for sure. And it's kind of it's a back and forth. I've never thought there was consensus on it or never sensed that there was a greater number of people leaning in a certain direction. I know Minnesota Deer Hunters Association is for getting rid of that shotgun zone, but that's a small subset of the total deer hunters in the state, really. And gosh, people will argue the safety thing back and forth until, you know, they drop. But again, like I said, with people I talk to who I know who hunt in that area, they're split as well. Some people love to be shooting rifles and others say, keep those things out of southern Minnesota.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I don't know if there's really a compromise. We've talked about it before, and I think we agree that either do it or don't do it. But right now we have what language in the Senate bill that mm-hmm. would exclude X counties. Blue Earth, Dodge, Freeborn, Maurer, Nicollet, and Olmsted.
That's just silly. That's ridiculous. You can't do that. It can't have a patchwork like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, even Olmsted. Yes, I'm aware that Rochester is in the middle of Olmsted County, but there are rural parts of that county. And if it's not rural and it's a municipality that needs to pass a specific ordinance that there's no firearms hunting, fine. I don't think anybody begrudges them that. I mean, we have that in the metro, right? There's areas you can only kill deer with bow, and we do a pretty good job with it. A patchwork of counties where this is allowed in some places and not in others, I just don't think that works.
Wasn't there something I read in that story, too, where counties could vote? County boards could vote each year to decide if they wanted to opt in or opt out? Talk about a conservation officer's nightmare.
Well, and I mean, that turns every county board race into a referendum on rifles and shotguns.
Yep.
I mean, who wants that? Yep. Yes, we've really made this one complicated. Well, again, it's one that probably is going to be reconciled one way or the other in the conference committee for this year. And then whatever happens, it'll probably be back next year, Tim. So we'll look forward to that.
I say just get rid of the shotgun zone. If you want to use a shotgun, use it. There, I've taken a stand.
Yeah, well, and that's not a bad stand. I agree. You listen to Outdoor News Radio. Rob Gerisline with Tim Spielman kicking off this week's broadcast. I mentioned another bill that Steve Green has authored that would basically require a 3/5 majority in the House or Senate before liquidating any, you know, big parcels of public land. I kind of like that. And, you know, he pointed out this wouldn't affect the tax forfeited lands. He said that goes in the tax bill every year. He said that usually passes almost unanimously. But some of these more controversial things, specifically like the White Earth State Forest and some of these other properties, you know, you got to get 60%, and, you know, so that one party that maybe just barely has a majority in either body can't sneak this through. You're going to have, you know, some bipartisanship to get it done.
Right. And Representative Matt Bliss from Pennington, also a Republican, has a companion bill in the House. And I believe Representative Bliss, when I spoke with him, I don't think either one of these guys believes it's going to go anywhere this session. But what do they call those when they just throw them out in a marker bill?
Sure, marker bill. But Green said he could offer it as an amendment and take a run at. And, Tim, it struck me that if he did offer it as an amendment, I mean, obviously you got leadership from the Democrats that could kill anything, I suppose. But if everybody just looked at that on its merit, it would seem like a fair number of Democrats could support that.
There you go off into your perfect world again.
Yeah, I know. I know.
But no, I agree. But I mean, I'm too cynical to think that the DFL would go along with some a Republican idea, even if it was a good one.
Another quick little item I had in my columns on the Boundary Waters is doing some master planning. I think it's significant. It's the first time they've done it since 1993. It's a big old chunk of wilderness, what, 1.2, 1.3 million acres. I would encourage folks, if you're a Boundary Waters person and have any interest in what's going on up there, to chime in. I think the public comment process goes through a good chunk of May.
Mm-hmm.
So
Didn't you say it was a 2 or 3 year process? So the old plan will be more like 34 years.
Yeah.
When we're done.
I mean, you think how much that wilderness has changed in terms of the number of visitors. I mean, when I started going there in the late 90s, I didn't see a lot of people up there. That has really changed. I think the pandemic, of course, contributed to that. Old Sean Parrish used to talk about how technology, how Kevlar canoes changed, you know, the wilderness, where someone now they're portaging a 40-pound canoe instead of a 90-pound canoe. And what does that mean? It means people are happier to, you know, go deeper into the wilderness.
Yeah, better gear, better equipment. And it seems like it's one of those destinations that once someone does it, it finds its way onto an annual calendar.
Yeah.
I know that's not true for everyone, but it seems like it's something on the checklist for a lot of people for their summer activities. You get people that return customers and your base builds.
Anyway, with that, Tim, out of time, but thanks for checking in. We'll talk to you next week.
That sounds good.
All right. Tim Spielman, editor at Minnesota Outdoor News. We're going to break. More Outdoor News Radio after these messages.
Ready for your next fishing adventure? Look no further than Lake City, Minnesota. Located in southeast Minnesota, nestled along the shores of Lake Pepin, this charming town offers some of the best fishing in the Midwest. Whether you're a seasoned angler or just starting out, Lake Pepin is teeming with walleye, bass, and more. And when you're not on the water, explore Lake City's quaint shops, delicious dining, and scenic beauty. Go to visitlakecity.org today and plan your trip to Lake City, Minnesota's South Shore.
Looking for the perfect summer getaway? Look no further than Minnesota's own Lake of the Woods. Welcome to the walleye capital of the world, where the next hook set could be your personal best fish of a lifetime. But it's not just about the fishing. From cozy resorts to charming lodges, Lake of the Woods offers summer fun for everyone. Plus, our charters and expert fishing guides are ready to make your experience unforgettable. Discover the magic of Lake of the Woods. Visit lakeofthewoodsmn.com.
The biggest public lands bash is headed to the heartland. Backcountry Hunters and Anglers North American Rendezvous is coming to the Minneapolis Convention Center April 18th through the 20th, and you don't want to miss it. Experience 3 action-packed days with top names in the outdoors, seminars, exhibitors, wild game cook-offs, calling competitions, a kids area, and more. Win big with prizes, auctions, and raffles all weekend. Full event and day passes are available at backcountryhunters.org under the Rendezvous tab. See you there.
Spring is here and your next outdoor adventure awaits. From hiking and biking our picturesque trails to kayaking or fishing our lake and waterways, Mason City and Clear Lake, Iowa offer endless opportunities for outdoor recreation. Gather your friends and family and discover the beauty of nature as you explore our stunning landscapes and immerse yourself in unforgettable experiences. Learn more at thisisnorthiowa.com.
Unleash the power of the Onyx Hunt app this turkey season and see how it'll become one of the best tools in your turkey vest. Use color-coded public and private land ownership information, tree species, and crop layers to scout from the comfort of your home. Then hit the field using compass mode, waypoints, and multiple base maps to help pin down more gobblers this spring. Use promo code ODN20 to receive 20% off your membership at onyxmaps.com/hunt.
Since 1967, generations of Minnesota sportsmen have trusted Outdoor News to keep them up to date with the latest news, pro tips, features, fishing reports, gear reviews, and more. For less than $1 per week, you can carry on the tradition and join thousands of Minnesota sportsmen by subscribing to Outdoor News. Whether you prefer a printed copy in your mailbox each week or the convenience of up-to-the-minute news on your smartphone or computer, we've got you covered. Subscribe today at outdoornews.com/subscribe.
Welcome back, everybody, to Outdoor News Radio. Rob Dreisline is still with you. Thanks for tuning in. If you like the broadcast, check out our website, outdoornews.com. We post all our content there. You can also subscribe to the good old print version by calling 800-535-5191. You can subscribe to print or digital, also via phone or at that website. I thought we'd devote this segment maybe to a non-hook and bullet topic and talk a little bit about camping and all the opportunities that exist in Minnesota, especially on state lands. And here to chat about that is Sarah Burhau. She's from the DNR's Park and Trails Division. She's a public relations supervisor, and she's going to spend a segment with us. Sarah, thanks a lot for chiming in. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks for taking some time to talk with me today.
You know, I mostly talk to a lot of the fish and wildlife folks over there, so it's always fun to get to know someone in a different division. So thanks for spending some time with us. Yeah, Sarah, you know, I'm a Boundary Waters guy. I tend to be more of a wilderness guy, not just the B-Dub, but also out west in Canada, and I like really getting into the backcountry. A few years ago, my kids and I decided to start hitting some state parks, and I was blown away by the opportunities at our state parks. We've got a whole bunch. They encompass a real wide range of habitats and flora and fauna and all those good things, don't they?
Right. We have 65 state parks and 9 state recreation areas, and they're all over the state with, like you said, very different landscapes and scenery. And in terms of camping opportunities, we have things for everyone, from the people who want to camp in a big cushy rig where it kind of almost feels like you're at home, to the people who really want to rough it and do that backcountry kind of camping too. So we've got something for everybody.
I was at a state park with my son and his cross country team late last summer in western Minnesota. And there was shame on me for not remembering the name of it, but there was a paved trail around the lake. I brought my bike. I'm pedaling around. And all of a sudden I go past this camping site. It was a bunch of yurts. And I was like, I did double take. Getting back to what you said, a real diverse bunch of opportunities out there.
Sure. And we do have some of those things that are kind of a hybrid between a camping and a lodging option for people who maybe don't want to sleep in a tent, want something a little more cushy than that, or maybe they're new to camping and don't have all of the equipment to do a different type of camping. But those places like camper cabins or yurts are good options for people that want something that is a little bit rustic, but not too rustic.
You've got a tool on your website, this Park Finder tool. Tell us a little bit about that. It looks like a good way for folks to kind of hone in on what they're looking for.
If there's something specific that you're looking for in your camping trip, the Park Finder tool on the DNR website is a really good option. You can filter by types of camping or lodging. You can filter by different types of trails that are available or other recreation opportunities. You want someplace that has a swimming beach, for example. You're looking for a spot with a waterfall, all kinds of different things you can filter by, and you'll get a list of all of the parks that have that feature or amenity that you're looking for. It's a great place to find the state park that's the best fit for you and the folks you'll be camping with.
What's a little bit of the difference between a state park and a state recreation area?
For the most part, the differences are kind of in statute and things that most people aren't going to notice when they visit the park. They have slightly different statutory regulations on what you can do within those different types of state land, but the campgrounds are pretty similar. You're not going to notice a lot of difference between those two different types of camping opportunities. There are some state recreation areas that have similar to state parks. They've got nice restroom and shower buildings. They've got similar amenities.
What does it cost to camp in a state park versus a state recreation area? Overall, what are the different fees that folks should be aware of if they want to camp in these facilities?
Regular non-electric campsite is going to be between $23 and $25 a night, depending on which park you're at. And then the sites that have more features, like their electric campsites, for example, if you're at an electric campsite, you would add $10 a night onto that. We don't have a lot of campsites within the state park system that have full hookups, like water and sewer as well. But there are a few places that have those, and that's another additional $5 a night on top of that. So most of our campsites are either non-electric or electric.
Is it too late to reserve some of these sites now, or how does that work? Are there some that are available first come, first serve?
Campsites within state parks and state recreation areas can be made up to 120 days in advance. So just to give you an idea, 120 days from Easter Sunday is going to be right at the end of July, in the last week of July. So that means that all of May, all of June, and almost all of July, except for the last couple of days, will be available to reserve now. So it's a good time to be looking at reservations that are available and make some plans if you haven't done so already.
We're chatting with Sarah Burhau. She is the PR supervisor for the Parks and Trails Division at the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. Think now, think ahead if you want to get out and enjoy some of the fabulous opportunities for camping on state lands this summer. Tell us about this Avenza Map app. What's that all about?
So that's a great way for people to ensure that they're not going to get lost when they're out on trails in the state parks. It's a free app. You can get it whether you have an Apple or an Android device. And it's a good idea to download the app while you're maybe at home or you're sure that you're going to have a good Wi-Fi connection or good cell phone service. And then you can go into, you'll click what's called the store, and there's lots and lots of maps in there. If you want to search for any of the state park maps, you can just search by the park's name. All of the DNR maps that are in that system are free to download. So there's no cost to download any of the Minnesota DNR maps. You'll find them as well for other things like state forests and wildlife management areas. There's lots and lots of Minnesota DNR maps in there. But once you've got the app and you've downloaded your map, you can navigate with that map whether you have a cell phone connection or Wi-Fi or you don't. If you are off the grid and you don't have a signal at all, you can still use that map. There'll be a little blue dot when you look at the map that follows where you are within that map. So you can always see where you are in relation to the features and that park or recreation area. So it makes it pretty hard to get lost. You can follow where you're going throughout the park, even if there isn't good cell service.
There's a ton of great information on the DNR website, mndnr.gov. There's something called the Summer Activities Guide, mndnr.gov/summer guide. All sorts of information on the different, you know, recreational opportunities in state parks and rec areas around the state. Are there ranger programs at a lot of state parks, like in the evening? That's something when I was younger, I just blew right past. But later when I had kids, I found that it was kind of a fun way to end a day, was sitting around and usually even someone in my line of work, I still lots of times walk away with some sort of little learning nugget at the end of one of those little programs.
We do have a lot of programming available in our parks. We have interpretive naturalists at many of our parks that plan programming. Some of those programs are on weekdays, some are evenings, there's a lot available on the weekends, actually. And anybody is welcome to join in those programs. We have an online calendar that people can find, again, at the DNR website that you've already mentioned. And that's a good spot to see what's coming up. If you've got a trip planned, you can check the calendar of events for the park that you're going to be at and see what's on the schedule while you're there.
If we have enticed listeners into saying, by golly, I got to get myself a reservation at a state park or rec area this summer, what do they do? How do they go about reserving a site?
So there are two different ways to do that. You can do that by phone. Most people make their reservations online. You can go to mndnr.gov/reservations. So you can search by park. If you know which park you want to go to, you can put in the park and the dates you'd like to go. And, you know, choose whether you want to do camping or find lodging or whatever you're interested in. And you can see the options there. You can book a reservation, like I said, up to 120 days in advance, and you can stay for up to 14 days in any location. We don't have seasonal campsites like some of the private campgrounds do. We have a 14-day limit, but you can look through all of the options. You can see what's available. If the park that was your first choice is full for the dates that you want to go, you can modify your search a little bit to choose different dates. We do hear sometimes that it can be hard to find reservations, but really that is the case at some of our more popular parks. We have more than 5,000 campsites across the state, and we never have a night where we don't have camping reservations available. So we encourage people to try a different location or maybe try camping during the week if they're having a hard time finding weekend campsites at their first choice park.
mndnr.gov/camping. Great place to start. Really easy website name to remember. mndnr.gov/camping. Sarah, final question. Do you have a favorite state park of your own that you might be willing to share to listeners?
It's a little bit like asking a parent who their favorite child is. You love them all, but for different reasons. I will say, I think Bearhead Lake State Park is my favorite. There are some really good hiking campsites at that park.
Yeah, that's up in that Boundary Waters country, isn't it? Beautiful part of the state. Well, Sarah, thanks so much for spending a segment with me. Thanks for all you do, and I encourage folks to get out and enjoy these state parks. I'm one of these guys that advocates for public lands, and I need to do a better job of actually using them, which is something I try to remind listeners now and then. So reserve now, enjoy our state parks and recreation areas. Go to mndnr.gov/camping. Sarah, thanks a lot.
Yes, thank you.
That was Sarah Burhau from the DNR's Parks and Trails Division. Appreciate her joining us. Let's break. More of the broadcast after these messages.
Fort Dodge, Iowa, outdoor and entertainment adventures are awaiting you. Discover Iowa's largest off-highway vehicle park, Gypsum City OHV Park, with 60 miles of trails, mudding areas, tracks, and an obstacle course. The area also boasts water, paved mountain bike, and equestrian trails. Head into town to enjoy public art and studios, an orchard, aquatic center, and family entertainment venue. Fill up with excellent Korean cuisine, pizza, ice cream, craft beer, or local wines. For more information, visit DodgeTheOrdinary.com.
The biggest public lands bash is headed to the heartland. Backcountry Hunters and Anglers North American Rendezvous is coming to the Minneapolis Convention Center April 18th through the 20th, and you don't want to miss it. Experience three action-packed days with top names in the outdoors, seminars, exhibitors, wild game cook-offs, calling competitions, a kids area, and more. Win big with prizes, auctions, and raffles all weekend. Full event and day passes are available at backcountryhunters.org under the Rendezvous tab. See you there.
Spring is here and your next outdoor adventure awaits. From hiking and biking, our picturesque trails, to kayaking or fishing our lake and waterways, Mason City and Clear Lake, Iowa offer endless opportunities for outdoor recreation. Gather your friends and family and discover the beauty of nature as you explore our stunning landscapes and immerse yourself in unforgettable experiences. Learn more at thisisnorthiowa.com.
Like every serious angler in this region, I want to make the most of my time on the water. That's why I read OutdoorNews.com. This all-new digital resource is loaded with valuable tips, lake profiles, up-to-date fishing reports, gear reviews, and breaking news on laws and regulations that affect the sports we love. Plus, OutdoorNews.com will help you catch more and bigger fish. Be prepared and get ahead of the crowd. Join OutdoorNews.com today.
Jason's Guide Service is your top option for Alaska's Kenai River salmon and trout fishing. If an Alaskan adventure is in your future, the Kenai River is essential to your experience, and to get the best river adventure, make it a day on the water with one of the experienced guides from Jason's Guide Service. Jason is already taking reservations for the summer of 2024, so visit jasonsguideservice.com for more information. That's jasonsguideservice.com.
Looking for the perfect summer getaway? Look no further than Minnesota's own Lake of the Woods. Welcome to the walleye capital of the world, where the next hook set could be your personal best fish of a lifetime. But it's not just about the fishing. From cozy resorts to charming lodges, Lake of the Woods offers summer fun for everyone. Plus, our charters and expert fishing guides are ready to make your experience unforgettable. Discover the magic of Lake of the Woods. Visit lakeofthewoodsmn.com.
Welcome back, everybody, to Outdoor News Radio. Rob Dreeslein, happy to be with you for another segment. I hope you like the chatter here. If so, check us out online at OutdoorNews.com or give us a call at 800-535-5191. Subscribe to print or digital versions, either via that phone number or through that website. Hey, a lot of fishing talk this time of year. And I want to talk about a fishing topic that I really love. I wish I had more experience with it. And that's steelheading up on our greatest of the Great Lakes, up on Lake Superior. And to talk with me about that now is a gentleman I've known for many years, Scott Thorpe, who's been a professional in a number of different fields, including being a steelheading guide. But Scott, you were telling me before we got going, you're retired and you're just fishing for fun now, huh?
Yeah, it's a great to look back at the guiding years, and then oftentimes wondering, you know, you want to just sometimes step in and think, if I were the one fishing, would we have caught more fish? Was it a good day or a bad day? You don't know. But yeah. Now I don't have those problems. I just cast in myself.
So the listeners understand this gentleman's credibility. He holds the state record for steelhead in Minnesota, caught it in the Devil Track River, which is a tributary of Lake Superior coming off the North Shore. Caught it back in 1980, huh?
Yeah. My brother and I were up for a week of fishing and taking turns working our way up the river. And he had just fished this run, and I came up to talk to him. We were thinking, well, maybe it was time to head back to the truck. And I literally stepped in front of him, made a couple of casts while we hashed up a plan, and hooked a fish right off from under his nose, which it's a long story, but it ended up being the state record in 1980, April 27th, I think.
Steelhead are rainbow trout, right? These are fish that are native to the west slope of the United States, specifically, I think, a patch in Northern California. I presume you know your natural history of rainbow trout pretty well, Scott. Stocked all over the world. They, what traditionally were an anadromous fish that would, what they would spawn in some of those rivers in Northern California, but then spend their life at sea. And that's kind of what these fish do in Lake Superior, right? They live their life in Lake Superior, our mini little sea here, our mini ocean, but then they spawn in these freshwater tributaries.
Yeah, and they were stocked in about the 1890s and became naturalized quite quickly. And then I think with the demise of lake trout populations in the 40s, late 40s and early 50s, and increase in smelt population, they hit a sort of a perfect niche. And the heydays of steelhead fishing, you know, maybe peaked maybe in the early 60s, and then we kind of go through some peaks and valleys as things have been changing in the lake. The lake is sort of returning back to some of its more original habitat. Lake trout have come back, mm-hmm. and smelt have diminished, and steelhead are entering some problem times. There have been a series of peaks and valleys, and I've been fortunate enough to have started fishing back in the good old days. I caught my first steelhead, I think 1969 or 1970. And then I watched a decline, and then it came back up. And I again got to fish all through some really good times. And I think now we're turning the corner. We're going to see some tougher fishing ahead of us in the next 4 or 5 years.
What would you attribute these tough times maybe that are coming? Is it because of a lack of forage, because of that change in the forage base up there? Certainly a lot of folks still target these fish, and we have real strict limits on harvest to try to protect the sport fishery, right?
Yeah, well, certainly these have been catch and release now since 1997 in Minnesota. No kill whatsoever. So it is an angling pressure that's the problem. We've just had a couple of really tough high water events in Minnesota in the last 2 or 3 years that have blown out the rivers to a point where any kind of juvenile production has been lost. You lose a year class, and they've just happened to have happened, and they've happened several times now. And so now we're going to have to pay the price for that, because these fish typically live in the river for about 2 years, then they go out to Lake Superior, and they come back in another year or another 2 years in various sizes. Mm-hmm. Now is when that cycle's going to come due, and we're going to have some lean years ahead.
You're listening to Outdoor News Radio. We're chatting with Scott Thorpe about steelhead fishing. Scott loves steelhead fishing probably more than anyone I've ever met. And let's talk about that for a moment. So, Scott, you were an architect. You decided to basically leave that career so that you could become a guide and really devote yourself to steelhead fishing. What is it about these fish that you love so much? And not just you, there's a lot of other people that really cherish steelhead.
They're big, and and you've got a pretty good chance of catching the fish of your lifetime when you fish for steelhead. You know, they average maybe 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 pounds. And so when you're used to fishing little stream trout, you know, with a dry fly or a nymph around here, and you catch a 14-incher, that's pretty exciting. But I got wrapped up in the steelhead thing when I saw my first one in 1966 laying in a snowbank. And I mean, I got down on my knees. I was stunned. This is the biggest fish I'd ever seen in my life. Beautiful silver steelhead laying on a snowbank. Angler had just caught it, you know, 1966. Then I think what brought me about is my father was in a high stress job, and he needed to get out of Dodge on weekends to get away from the stress. He couldn't work if he wasn't there at the office. So we'd run up to the North Shore from St. Paul every weekend for all the month of April and the month of May. And that's what we did. We fished. It was an escape mechanism for him and we just kind of got carried away.
I think rainbow trout might be the most stocked fish in the world. It, maybe not by numbers. I think, you know, we stock a lot of walleye fry that might top that number wise, but they're one of the most stocked fish in the world. I think partially because they're gorgeous. They're beautiful fish. I was talking to a guy in Western Wisconsin about fishing stream rainbow trout in some of the smaller streams. And he said, it's kind of hard. He said, lots of times he sees them get stocked in Wisconsin streams and they all want to go down river. In his neck of the woods, they want to go down to the Wisconsin River and the Mississippi. They seem like they're constantly searching for bigger water. Is that your experience with the stream rainbow trout?
Yeah, I think that's the case. I think that the genetics of rainbows is when they get stressed by heat, I think they have a tendency to head downstream and they're migratory by their very nature. And that may have something to do with the strains that were originally stocked in Minnesota and Wisconsin were steelhead strains originally. But I would think that these days, modern strains might not be so migratory. But this certainly is the case that they seem to head out. You know, you look at the brook trout and brown trout and rainbows in the tributaries to Lake Superior. And they have a tendency, unless they're up in the headwaters, as soon as the rivers start to get low and they start to get warm, they go seeking bigger water and they find it in Lake Superior and it naturally creates a migratory fish.
How do you fish them, Scott? Are you a pure fly fisherman? Are you using dry flies, wet flies? When I went out with Sean Parrish a few times, we were using what he called the North Shore yarn fly. Is that what you employ, or what are folks most likely to see on the end of your fly rod?
I switch around. I'm not a purist by any means. As I've gotten to be a more advanced fisherman and I've caught lots and lots of steelhead, I become more selective in how I fish. These days, I like to swing with a double-handed rod. It's the least effective way to catch fish. So I'm using a streamer, and I'm swinging it across the current, and I'm looking for that one steelhead that is aggressive. A far more effective way to fish is like Sean would fish, and that would be with a spawn sack, okay. You know, a bait of some sort. It's got to be on the bottom. They don't move a whole lot. The water's cold. They don't chase much. They're not actually feeding like you would, like a trout would feed. They're biting out of more of an instinctual thing. So anything that looks like an egg or yarn, they're also biting on insects. And sometimes it might even be just an instinctive response to when they were small fish living in the river. So I use nymphs. This last week I've been up on the Brule. All the fish that I caught but one were caught on a stonefly nymph, about an inch and a half black stonefly nymph fly, a pattern. And I also caught one fish on a bead, which imitates a single fish egg, just a small little orange bead. Mm-hmm. I'll use a spawn sack if it's super cold water. So it's flexible. The one key is you got to be on the bottom. I usually fish with a fly rod, with a floating fly line, a couple of split shot and a strike indicator if I'm not swinging.
When I went out with Parrish, I mean, he really emphasized you got to put it right in front of him to your point that these fish aren't moving around a whole lot. Scott, folks might be listening and say, I want to give this steelheading thing a try. Where would a newbie start? I know there's the Lake Superior Steelhead Association. Steelheaders.org, is that website? Is that a logical place to start? Any other place you'd recommend?
That's a good place to start. I think that if I were a beginner angler, one thing I would emphasize is you can learn by watching people that know what they're doing. This was always advice to my clients when I was guiding is go to a river like the Knife where there's going to be a lot of people and you say, wow, there's so many people. This is way too crowded. Sit on the bank and watch for about 30 minutes and watch the people that are catching the fish and look at where they're doing it and how they're doing it.
Yeah.
Are they fishing with a center pin? Are they using a spinning rod with a float? Are they drift fishing? Are they fly fishing? And watch them catch a couple. Then go down and talk to them and beg for mercy. Say, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm a complete newbie. Help me, please. Show me your rig. Sometimes guys will just say, you know, you've never caught a steelhead before? You go, uh-uh. I have no idea what I'm doing. Well, here, take my spot. You'll learn a lot just by watching because steelhead are not everywhere in every pool. They like to be in certain spots in the pool at certain water conditions, certain levels of the water. And the old timers know where these spots are, and the beginners are just kind of fishing around the fringes. You can learn a lot just by sitting down and watching, even if it's really crowded.
excellent advice in a lot of facets of life, especially the outdoors. Scott, thanks so much for joining us. Great segment. I learned a lot. I suspect a lot of our listeners did too. It's an honor to have you on the broadcast, the man who possesses the Minnesota state record steelhead caught in the Devil Track back in 1980. And I'm so glad you're still out there hitting the water and as dedicated to this sport as you are.
Good to talk to you again, Rob.
Take care, Scott Thorpe. We appreciate him joining us here on Outdoor News Radio. We're going to grab a break, but we'll be back. More of the broadcast after these messages.
Ready for your next fishing adventure? Look no further than Lake City, Minnesota. Located in southeast Minnesota, nestled along the shores of Lake Pepin, this charming town offers some of the best fishing in the Midwest. Whether you're a seasoned angler or just starting out, Lake Pepin is teeming with walleye, bass, and more. And when you're not on the water, explore Lake City's quaint shops, delicious dining, and scenic beauty. Go to visitlakecity.org today and plan your trip to Lake City, Minnesota's South Shore.
Fort Dodge, Iowa, outdoor and entertainment adventures are awaiting you. Discover Iowa's largest off-highway vehicle park, Gypsum City OHV Park, with 60 miles of trails, mudding areas, tracks, and an obstacle course. The area also boasts water, paved mountain bike, and equestrian trails. Head into town to enjoy public art and studios, an orchard, aquatic center, and family entertainment venue. Fill up with excellent Korean cuisine, pizza, ice cream, craft beer, or local wines. For more information, visit dodgetheordinary.com.
The biggest public lands bash is headed to the heartland. Backcountry Hunters and Anglers North American Rendezvous is coming to the Minneapolis Convention Center April 18th through the 20th, and you don't want to miss it. Experience three action-packed days with top names in the outdoors, seminars, exhibitors, wild game cook-offs, calling competitions, a kids area, and more. Win big with prizes, auctions, and raffles all weekend. Full event and day passes are available at backcountryhunters.org under the Rendezvous tab. See you there.
Since 1967, Outdoor News has been Minnesota's go-to news source for all things out of doors. Generations of hunters and anglers have welcomed Outdoor News into their home each week, enjoying the most up-to-date news, features, columnists, fishing and hunting reports, gear reviews, and much, much more. For less than a dollar a week, you can join thousands of other Minnesota sportsmen and continue the long-standing tradition of subscribing to Outdoor News. Both print and digital versions are available. Start your subscription today at outdoornews.com/subscribe.
Okoboji, Iowa has thousands of acres of lakes for fishing and public land for hunting, making it Iowa's best outdoor playground all year long. Start planning your next trip to Okoboji for fishing, hunting, swimming, or camping in one of our state parks. When you get off the water, enjoy our many locally owned restaurants and attractions, making Okoboji a favorite destination for your entire family. Plan your next trip at vacationokoboji.com. Okoboji, Iowa's best outdoor playground.
Hey, hon, what you doing with your phone? Taking pictures?
No, I'm asking it questions.
Like what?
Hey, Bobo, do flowers have best friends?
I'm sorry, I'm afraid I don't know that.
Hey, follow me. I want to show you something. Look, flowers do have best friends.
Whoa.
Some answers can only be found in nature. Discover the unsearchable. Visit discovertheforest.org to find a trail near you. Brought to you by the United States Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Welcome back, everybody. Final segment of this week's broadcast of Outdoor News Radio. I'm Rob Jerisline. I'm so glad you're with us. So we've had a good show, and we're going to wrap it up with our friend Tim Lesmeister. Read him in our print version of Outdoor News. I know he's got something for our fishing opener edition, or you can read him online at outdoornews.com. Call 800-535-5191, or again, you can subscribe to digital or print at that website. Tim, welcome. It's very good to see you. It sounds like you're going to be heading back north, and you're going to hit the Lake of the Ozarks, huh?
I do have to get up to Lake of the Ozarks here because the crappie fishing is starting to heat up there, and I'm going to hang out with my brother-in-law for a few days.
Good.
And we'll be crappie fishing, catching some nice big bass. You always catch a few big bass when you're fishing for crappies. And it's just a lot of fun. It's a great lake to fish. Lots of areas to explore in that huge body of water.
A lot of shoreline, right? I mean, it's a reservoir.
Oh, it's just incredible.
Yeah, just a ton of shoreline. Yeah, I've read about that. I've never fished it. Tim, we've got some content here I wanted to talk to you about this week. Last week and this week, I printed a story I spent a lot of time developing with the author of the piece, John McLean. It's called In Search of the Good Water, and it retraces McLean's steps as he retraced Hemingway's trout fishing haunts in northern Michigan last week, the Upper Peninsula, and then the second part this week was out in the Ketchum, Idaho area where Hemingway spent the last several years of his life. McLean pointing out that Jack Hemingway, Ernest's oldest son, had said that his father really didn't fish much out there during his later years, that he had lost a bunch of his fly fishing equipment and kind of got out of the sport. And McLean making the point, he just couldn't believe that was possible, that a guy who wrote The Big Two-Hearted River as eloquently as Hemingway did must have taken advantage of the incredible fishing water out there in Ketchum, Idaho. Sounds like you've spent some time in both of the areas that McLean profiled in these stories.
Oh, yeah, and I really loved the term that John used to describe those waters out in western U.S. He describes those streams out in the western part of the United States with such eloquence. It's a great read. And, you know, I don't think that equipment that Ernest Hemingway lost during transport was actually lost. I think it was stolen. Obviously, someone was transporting this gear. It was this fishing gear, a lot of great fly angling stuff.
Sure.
And it never made it to the destination.
Mm-hmm.
Lost? I think they really need to call it what it is, stolen. But anyway, beyond that, the fact is that Ernest Hemingway liked big water. He liked ocean fishing.
Yeah,
he liked
yeah.
big fish.
Yep.
So making the transition back into, you know, stream fishing and small river fishing for rainbow and brown trout, you know, after he lost his gear may have been just a little too much. So he stuck with hunting. I mean, I don't think he ever lost his passion for hunting. I mean, when he was living out in those western states, he hunted like crazy. But the bottom line is he did do some fishing out in the West. There's pictures of him holding up some rainbow trout. And this two-part series you did, retracing those steps, was a really great read.
It's a fascinating piece from multiple levels. I mean, John McLean, he's the son of Norman McLean, who wrote A River Runs Through It. And John is an accomplished author in his own right. So it was fascinating to, you know, read about his experiences. He had been a reporter in the Chicagoland area when he was younger, and he used to go to northern Michigan to fish and talks about how he fished the two-hearted and never had much luck. And it wasn't until later that he realized, based on the writings of some other authors and some of his research, that it was the Fox River near Seney that Hemingway and his buddies probably fished after World War One. Hemingway had fished in the southern peninsula of Michigan prior to World War One, but his character, Nick Adams, in The Big Two-Hearted, is going back trying to recover from some mental anguish. It's not clear in the story what's happening, but we know from Hemingway's life that it involved World War One. It's an area that's near and dear to my heart, Tim. I lived in the Seney area for 3 years when I was a kid. I loved it up there. I absolutely loved it. It was a very hard area to leave. So I had some personal connection to it. And as you and I have talked, I've been reading a lot of Hemingway the past couple of years, kind of going back and rereading some of it and really enjoying his work.
And, you know, McLean, when he talked about the book, which is Fishing the Two-Hearted River, he said the story, when I reread it, was as fresh and full of life as a trout just taken from a stream. What a great way to describe it. And he said that his father and he really were motivated by reading Hemingway's books to actually do the stuff that they did, realizing that you could actually write books that are interesting, stories that are interesting about fly fishing and about the great outdoors. His father wrote A River Runs Through It, you know, after he retired and had been, you know, basically somewhat sedentary for a while, and they kind of convinced him to start doing some writing, and he started working on that piece, and it turned out to be
a masterpiece. Yeah. I don't have much experience in the Ketchum, Idaho area. I'd like to see it. I'd like to, you know, maybe visit some of Hemingway's haunts there. I've never been to Key West either, which is a place where he lived. He also lived in Cuba for a few years, and that's when he was really hardcore into the big water. And, you know, there is something to be said, Tim, once you have fished a lot of fresh water and then you start fishing salt water and big fish that all they do is spend their lives in the ocean fighting tides and everything in the ocean is trying to eat you, going from saltwater back to freshwater is kind of challenging. You've probably experienced that in your life a bit.
Oh, I do. I do. I fish a lot of saltwater all winter long and then come up north in the summer and fish the lakes and the rivers up north. And it's definitely a big transition to make. There's no question. But, you know, you talk about all those areas that Hemingway lived and explored, and I've been to all of those areas except for Cuba, and all of them have incredible resources. You can see that Hemingway, he didn't mess around. He went where the hunting and the fishing was really good, and he wrote about it and wrote stories that were phenomenal.
A couple quick points. One, his boat, the Pilar, is still in Havana. I guess there's a museum there. So if I ever get to Cuba, I would love to see that. The Pilar, of course, named after one of his characters in For Whom the Bell Tolls. He did a couple of big-time safaris in Africa. Probably best documented his first trip in Green Hills of Africa. And then after he passed, his son Patrick took some of his journals and crafted True at First Light, about some of Hemingway's later trips to Africa. I believe that was in the 1950s, late 40s or 50s, that he went back over there. I had the pleasure of meeting Patrick Hemingway once out in Montana, sat right next to him at a dinner. He is still alive, the only one of Hemingway's three sons who is still alive. Jack Hemingway was one of the Idaho Fish and Game Commissioners, I think in the 70s. Tim, you might remember that history better than me.
Yeah, and he was very much into that region and the natural resources out there.
And a big-time fly fisherman. Big-time fly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and that the waters out there are great. That Bigwood River in Ketchum, where Hemingway lived, was considered one of the top rivers in the state. You talk about that area around Seney, Michigan, where this book was written about, and there's so many small lakes around there, so much camping, and yeah. So many great places to go if you want to fish waters that are basically untouched. No one even goes on the rivers there. And it's not the best trout fishing anymore, I would say. The rivers probably have aged, but you can get into some incredible bass fishing on these rivers now.
Looking at some of those pictures of the Fox River, you can tell that it looks like challenging water to access. That is thick country, as you and I were talking off air. It's reminiscent of Alaska without the mountains. You could probably float a canoe or one of your kayaks, Tim, and get back there and access some of that water pretty well. But I think for the most part, very few people fish those areas.
Yeah, I typically use kayaks now. I have some 10-foot Hobies that I use on these small rivers now, and they fish well. So it's a whole different experience. A lot of what you're doing here is just using the kayak to get from pool to pool, and then you actually bring the kayak up on the shore or up onto a sandbar or a gravel bar along the edge or even in the middle sometimes and just cast from shore. But that's how you'd probably want to attack some of these rivers in that upper peninsula. Yeah, it was a great two-part series. I would say if you're picking up Outdoor News at the newsstand, make sure you get them both. And if you're a subscriber, lucky you.
Swing on down to the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers Rendezvous this weekend at our booth. We'll have copies of both editions if folks would like to pick up some copies. Yeah, I've loved reading Hemingway. He was an imperfect man. He was far from perfect, but he wrote some amazing literature, some amazing short stories. Died tragically at his own hand, committed suicide in 1961, but he left behind just some remarkable literature. And in some ways, I think he was one of our first great outdoors writers. And there aren't any other outdoor journalism outlets that are printing this kind of content, Tim. And we don't do a lot of it, but I think once in a while we need to reread and understand some of our outdoor writing history, and that's why these pieces were important to me.
I still have some of my favorite Field and Stream and Outdoor Life articles that were written back in the 60s and 70s that I've saved. You know, stories by Ted Trueblood, guys that wrote Me and Joe stuff.
Yep.
Gary Clancy was one of the greatest Me and Joe writers that ever existed. He wrote for Outdoor News for years. Yep. He was an amazing storyteller. And that's
people loved it. People love that stuff.
We need storytellers. There's no question.
Yep.
That's what that writing was all about, telling the story.
Very well put. Well, Tim, thanks for spending a segment with me. It was fun recapping out with you, and we'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good. I'll catch up to you soon.
Thank you to Mr. Lesmeister, all of our other guests, and all the listeners who joined us for the past hour. I hope everyone has a great week out of doors. I'm Rob Gerisline signing off for Outdoor News Radio. Missed a segment from this week's edition of Outdoor News Radio? You can hear a podcast of the complete program at OutdoorNews.com or via your favorite podcast streaming platforms. And for the rest of the story on the topics we cover here on the program, get yourself or a friend a subscription to Outdoor News. Just visit OutdoorNews.com. And don't forget to join us next week on this station to talk everything out of doors.